Merry Christmas, everybody. It is December 25th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Timothy Dennis.
I'm Katie Henriksen.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Jackie Froelich.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And during this week, this is the third year we've done this, we talk about some of our favorite stories that we've done in the previous 12 months. The first voice you heard today was Timothy Dennis. You've been with us since August?
Very beginning of August, yes.
What do you think?
I love it.
Really?
I couldn't complain, you know?
Okay.
I mean, it's
you
the
should
best
actually
job ever.
Look at his expression right now. I'm just kidding.
You grew up in Washington County.
Yeah, south part of the county.
Rural part of the county.
Mm-hmm. East of Winslow.
East of Winslow. What? Just unincorporated east of Winslow?
Sunset is what people refer to it as. Like, my parents live just down the road from the Sunset Volunteer Fire Department, Sunset Cemetery, all that type of stuff.
Okay, this is an amazing... I didn't do this on purpose. But
well,
this
works out really well.
It segues right into the first thing I want to talk about, which is when Antoinette and I were in Sunset this year.
Yes, one of our field trips.
Yes. We went to a
field trip.
It's a field trip.
It was a field trip. Robert Ginsberg had told us about these great waterfalls that were on the Crawford County, Washington County line.
And Robert Ginsberg is the host of Shades of Jazz.
Right, and an avid outdoors person. And so he had been after me for a couple of years to go out and do these stories. And so he took us to some waterfalls. It was a pair of well-experienced outdoor guides that led us into the forest. Robert Ginsberg is, of course, the host of Shades of Jazz on KUAF. But for years, he also owned Uncle Sam Safari Outfitters in Fayetteville, and he spent most of his life exploring the outdoor world. Stephen Marquardt is the president of Marquardt Ironworks in West Fork. Born in Arkansas, he was raised in Iowa and returned to his native state as an adult, and he's been hiking into the rough and wild spots ever since.
There is no breaking news associated with our final story today. The natural wonders of the Boston Mountains have been here a long time. We're certainly not the first people to hike down a ravine in search of a waterfall.
But in an age with hundreds of TV channels, thousands of apps and podcasts, and seemingly millions of reasons to stay close to home, we thought a reminder of what's not too far from your backyard, ready for exploration, was a good idea.
On a warmer than usual March afternoon, with the promise of seeing something that not many people see, we followed Stephen and Robert into a thick patch of territory near the Washington County-Crawford County line. The hike began at one of the higher elevation points in Arkansas, nearly 2,300 feet above sea level.
There are no trails here, and trying to explain exactly where we were might require the rest of the time we have on this program. If you look on a map and find the pioneer communities of Sunset, Temple Hill, and Health, you'll get an idea of where we were hiking inside the Ozark National Forest. Stephen Marquardt has a place near here, but despite being close to the waterfalls, he hasn't been here that often. This trip requires a commitment of time.
I've only been down here probably three or four times, maybe four or five times, over the last 3 years.
Is that how long you've had
I found this waterfall by accident. I decided to just come up here and park and walk down to Frog Bayou. This is the stream that we turn on to go down to the waterfall. In fact, we can just turn anywhere and just walk through the woods.
This is where the instructions include turn off the paved road.
This is the end of civilization right here.
The waterfall in question is still beyond this end of civilization. We continue to sidestep down, grabbing onto trees along the way. Eventually, the creek stops and goes straight down. Experienced hikers like Stephen and Robert are aware of where they are. Inexperienced hikers like us might not know we're about to stumble over the top of a waterfall. We literally can't see the forest through the trees.
It's kind of like the world comes to an end.
Yeah.
That's going to be the waterfall area there. It's a little ways down there, but it just drops off. And then there's the other one, so as you're going down, you're dropping down in elevation extremely fast.
Heavy rains just days before have made rocks slippery, kept the stream that feeds the waterfall flowing. We keep following that stream until a light spray can be felt, water carried by a breeze off the waterfall back into our faces. And suddenly we're there, on top of a crater, lines and lines of geological layers stacked upon each other. We're looking straight down. We can only guess how far a drop we're looking at.
I wish I had my tape. That's probably 30 feet.
This is what Stephen calls a wild waterfall. If you look on a topographical map of the region, you won't see the falls mentioned, listed, or named. It's not the highest, nor the most spectacular waterfall in the Ozarks, but its apparent secluded location makes it quite the find.
This is one of the nicest, biggest waterfalls I've found that's wild, without any trails or signs of people, no trash. I wonder how beneficial this spray is to those buttercups. They seem to grow on this side, and that spray is always going over here.
That's interesting.
Because they're not on the other side.
Stephen says the falls are even more spectacular when seen from below, and there are other smaller falls to be seen. So down we hike. And at this point, a public service announcement. Hiking, actually what we're doing is bushwhacking without the benefit of trail or path, can be dangerous. There are small problems, like meadows of poison ivy, and bigger ones, like sheer drops of several stories. This kind of exploration is safer and better if you have good map, compass, and GPS skills. And as Robert Ginsburg points out, this kind of trip is not for a novice hiker to do on her or his own.
No, not without someone who knew the area and knew the hazards of skirting along bluff lines and alternatives. I wouldn't know. And, you know, novices are, I think they even have this issue like with Ozark Highlands Trail groups and Ozark Society. They try to rate a hike as easy, moderate, extreme, and those are all on sliding scales for various people. But this is pretty extreme. This is totally off trail.
What would you call, I mean, if you were to rate what we're doing today?
On a 1 to 5, say?
Yeah.
This is up there in the 4s, you know, it's boulder hopping. It's very steep, several places that are very exposed where you just can't afford to fall. Typically on a trail, if you stumble, you might scrape your elbow or something. But you know, some of the places that we skirted around there, you only get one chance not to fall.
This is why having an experienced outdoorsman like Stephen Marquardt is a help. He studies every step before moving, confident of a safe landing before taking his foot off the ground. His knowledge doesn't just keep you safe, though. As carefully as he contemplates safety, he examines his surroundings. He literally stops every 10 or 12 paces to point out a bird you've never been this close to in a city or a wildflower you won't see every day.
See that? That's pawpaw. It's like a little maroon or colored rose.
It's so pretty. It does. It petals out like a rose, just not as many leaves.
You wouldn't find them that often on the south slopes, but it's in this ravine. It's protected.
You know, with someone like Stephen, too, he is so deliberate about these. How often do you go on a hike where it's like every 10 feet there's something that's worth identifying and noticing? And
Stephen says his deep interest in birds, plants, and nature began when he was very young, an interest he says that grows to this day. As we sit below the waterfall and he takes a granola bar from his backpack, he considers where we are.
So I read a poem a long time ago when I was in my 20s. I think it was a Japanese poem, maybe a translation. It said the names of things bring them closer. And I've always thought of that when you know the names of different things, plants and animals and wildflowers and things, that you somehow feel closer. You learn to identify as you're walking. You just see the same things all the time. And so you gradually, looking in books, you gradually figure out what they are.
Is that what you've done since you were a kid?
Yeah. I studied birds in Iowa and found 290-some bird species in Iowa as a kid. Born in Arkansas and raised in Iowa and then came back here.
But here's one of the great bonuses to exploring the Ozarks and Ouachitas. Even if you've poked around the outdoors often and can identify birds and plants at a distance, every journey into nature is different and surprising.
Pretty much every time there's some high point, something unusual, you know. Finding an unusual orchid or seeing a bear or something. There's always something.
Have you seen bears around here?
Yeah. I chased one up over on that side of the mountain. I chased one up and it went up into the woods and then turned around and came back, and I heard these twigs snapping and I couldn't see it, and all of a sudden it walked out about 50 feet away from me and stood there looking at me. It's quite exciting. It was curious.
As we continue to trek down below the big waterfall toward a smaller one, our guides explained why a day away from the usual routine can mean so much, and they deliver lessons along the way.
Even though I grew up in St. Louis, my earliest memories are following the storm sewers off into the wooded areas as a child, truly. Me and my dog, and I, you know, and then my family, our vacations were typically when we went on vacation, we'd be to the Lake of the Ozarks in a cabin. So I, at a very young age, was kind of indoctrinated into the marvels of nature.
I don't know. It's meditative, studying nature. I find that it's absolutely impossible to be depressed or to have any ill will or bad feelings. It's just impossible. When I get out in the woods, I just feel at ease and happy.
You know, we're on a major fault here that's creating this drainage and all this water coming through. And obviously, there's water that's pirated out of the main drainage above ground and seeping through these big cracks. You see the deer tracks?
Yeah. Big deer. That one shows a waterfall in evolution, you know, because it's actually been damaged by that big tree coming down and knocking a big chunk of it off. So you see the orange colors of the rock exposed.
This, to me, is what great artists spend their lives attempting to capture. The beauty of nature, the inspiration for all art, I believe.
Our guides for our adventure in the Ozark National Forest were Stephen Marquardt and Robert Ginsburg. They took us to two waterfalls, a big one with at least a 30-foot drop and another smaller one that allows visitors to slip behind. Of course, any hike that goes down means a return trip up. Straight up, in this case. The hike back to our car covered about 400 feet in elevation, and what seemed just like a few feet as the crow flies.
Those were waterfalls near Sunset, near where you grew
where
up.
Timothy Dennis grew
yes.
up.
Yes. Okay, so Timothy Dennis, because you have this sort of background of growing rural, one of the stories that you did this year that you really wanted to do was about hay.
That's right. I grew up on a cattle and chicken farm. Now it's just cattle, but I heard from my father and many of my parents' neighbors about the problems they were having feeding their cattle this year because of the drought. It basically killed all of the hay fields that they had. And these farmers, they were having to spend, you know, quite a bit of money just reseeding their fields. And there were even some farmers who had to sell off, you know, part or all their herds. So it just seemed like a really interesting story to me. So it just I decided to do it. Although the temperatures are beginning to drop as we move into fall, farmers are still feeling the heat of the drought that has plagued Arkansas for much of the year. The biggest problem for farmers is the lack of hay produced during the year. John Jennings is a professor of forage management with the University of Arkansas Extension Service in Little Rock. He says that the entire year has been fraught with setbacks for cattle producers looking for hay with which to feed their stock.
Started out with a warm season in the spring, so everything was coming on early, and then it immediately turned cool and then dry, and that slowed down the forage growth. And then it was hot and dry through the summer, so it prevented any forage growth. We had armyworms in the spring, which took out some of our spring pasture and spring hay crop. And then the fall rains that we finally started getting, the armyworms came in and started taking that again, too. So it's been a real challenge, one following the next.
Brian Fuchs with the National Drought Mitigation Center says that each drought is unique, characterizing this year's drought as several dry spells embedded with a few periods of precipitation.
I think this year is a good example of that, where we did have some dryness, recovered somewhat through the winter and early spring, and actually had some fairly good rains, and then it just really went dry and hot through the summer. And then you throw in a tropical event here this fall already, and it just makes the landscape change so abruptly. And there's parts of the state that really have not seen much of the relief this fall so far and are still waiting to see if that drought is going to break. So, you know, the conditions that we're seeing have been unique in the fact that not only with the dryness that we had, which was very severe, but we also had the intense heat, and that's happened for two summers in a row now.
But while the rains and tropical storm events of the past 2 months have brought some relief to the drought, Jennings says that the rain is too late for a fall hay crop, which would have eased the strain of increasing feed costs for farmers.
It's making some pasture, but it's not making enough growth for hay harvest. There's a difference. It has to be at a certain harvestable size before you can really cut it for hay. The weather cooled off along with that rain, and for our warm season grasses, where the primary hay crop would come from for this late in the year, can't grow during the cool temperatures.
According to a study released last week by the University of Arkansas Division of Agriculture, the cost of hay delivered to fields increased by more than 50%. That same study gives a conservative estimate that the drought has already cost cattle ranchers $128 million, and that 3% of ranchers surveyed planned on selling all of their livestock. With little hay produced in the spring and summer, no fall hay crop, and rising feed prices, farmers have taken to trimming their cattle head counts, and some have even sold their entire herds. Alan Hales of the Fort Smith Livestock Auction says that the sellouts will have a noticeable impact on the cattle markets going forward into next year.
We've had a dairyman that's been in business and his family for about 50 or 60 years, and they're completely liquidating the dairy because the milk isn't bringing enough to cover the feed cost. And it's really a shame, and what's going to happen is, just like the hogs and the cattle, the numbers are going to be down severely, and we're going to see eventually that's going to go to the marketplace. We're going to see less supply, and depending on the demand, if the demand's there, then the price is going to go up.
The cattle market is similar to most other markets. Prices at the market are subject to supply and demand. With excess supply comes decreased demand and decreased prices, but when demand at the dinner table exceeds the supply in the field, that's when prices at the grocery store soar. To comprehend the dynamics of the cattle market, one must understand that many ranchers plan the breeding cycles of their mama cows so that the calves will be at a mature size when market prices are best in the fall. Many ranchers plan on having calves in the early months of the year so that the calves will be large enough to sell for reasonable profit in the following fall. According to the UA study, 73% of farmers surveyed sold calves earlier than in a typical year. Hales says that cattle prices are already up because of recent activity in the market.
We're already seeing that the marketplace on these replacement cows and heifers that are bred, you know, going to have calves, we're seeing them already $200 to $300 a higher a pair. If we have grass next spring and the numbers down like I think they're going to be, we're going to see some of the highest price stock cows we've seen in a long time to buy back. And that's what's dangerous. When you go out there and give $1,500, $1,800 for a pair, that's a lot of money, and you put your interest and feed in that. You've got to get quite a bit for that calf. So it's a risky business. It really is.
Harold Sargent of the Farmers Livestock Association in Springdale says that this year there have been quite a few farmers selling their entire herds.
That's about stopped now. You know, I mean, there for a couple of months, there were a lot of people selling their entire herds. But, you know, since it started raining and the grass is replenished, well, the complete sellout has stopped.
But when the sale of whole herds has been avoided, other drastic measures have been taken. According to the UA study, 49% of ranchers surveyed reduced their herds by selling more mature cows than usual, and 41% of ranchers also said that they plan to sell more mature cows in the fall, in addition to having sold replacement heifers that would have otherwise replaced mature cows. But Kent Reading of Interstate 40 Livestock Association in Ozark says that the drought has ended the farming careers of some ranchers.
There'll be a few people that want to restock, but a lot of people that sell out are going to be, some of them are a little older, and they're just going to give it up, and they're not going to replenish. They're not going to rebuild their cow herds.
The sell-off of livestock herds is something that Fuchs says the Drought Mitigation Center takes into account when determining the long-term effects of a drought.
Sometimes there's breeding lines that have taken years to accomplish that sometimes get lost in a situation like this. And so to see those stocking rates get back up to where they were, that also will take time because you just don't replenish those numbers overnight.
This is Ozarks at Large. Staff here, we're sitting around on this Christmas thinking about some of our favorite stories of this year. Yesterday we heard some about Prairie that Christina did. Now we're going to hear about Granges.
Right. Jackie Froelich here. And, okay, Antoinette, when you hear the word Grange, what do you think of?
I think of needing a dictionary. Because right. I didn't know what this was when
exactly.
I asked Kyle when I saw you were doing the story. I was like, what is that?
It's a really archaic term. But if you think about it, Granges came into being in the 1870s. There was no internet. There was no television. Telephones, had they been... when was a telephone invented?
1880s, right?
Okay, so communication
invented,
was really lacking.
If, yeah.
Right. So granges were established in these rural areas to help people connect with each other, for technology transfer, to share food, resources, and also to kind of coalesce political actions. It was really cool entities, but they've all but disappeared, although you can see the grange houses on the landscapes in rural areas still. Many of them are vacant and kept by local communities just because they're kind of, again, to use the word, relics. So the National Grange of the Order of Patrons of Husbandry. That's what
I love
the
that title.
Formal name, established 145 years ago, and it was one of the first groups to admit women. This is, a patrons of husbandry, they admitted women. Very cool. So we have 2,100 granges in 37 states, and they're nonprofit, nonpartisan social organizations that advocate for rural interests. Right now, primarily, it's affordable insurance and broadband. This is what I discovered. We have no operating granges in Arkansas. We might have one kind of resurrect up in Springdale. I'm going to keep an eye out on that one. So I had to travel all the way to Colcourt, Oklahoma on the Flint Creek watershed, which was gorgeous. I love taking that trip to find a grange. Locals fish and wade this hot summer morning in the crystal clear green waters of Flint Creek, just south of Colcourt, Oklahoma, population 635. And up an embankment above them stands the Old Union Grange Hall, number 349, established in 1956. The hall's empty today, but once a month, Jennifer Larman packs up her family to go to grange meetings. She grew up just down the road from here on her family's farm.
And us kids weren't allowed in the meetings, but we could always go into the kitchen and sit and play games in the kitchen.
Today, Jennifer lives 10 miles away, north of the Grange Hall, 3 miles west of Colcourt, Oklahoma, on her 25-acre farm with her husband, Don. They've been married 48 years. They raise cattle. She takes in sewing. And they've also raised a beautiful flock of children who literally grew up on the Grange.
It was a night out because we didn't have a lot of money at that point in time. So it was something to do.
Families would bring a covered dish and share a meal and ideas on how to improve life in the community.
When it started years ago, way before ours started, it was kind of, long time ago, people didn't have all these games for kids. And they didn't have a time the families all got together in the community. And it was just like a gathering for them to talk about things, to talk about their crops, to talk about their cattle, their milk stock, and things like that. And then it became more and more serious, and they started kind of getting together and staying together for prices and stuff like that. I project it in my own views as something like a union, but it wasn't a union, but it was something that they could stay together and hold out for a better price or something to that effect.
And all Oklahoma granges get to share in one cost-effective product.
Homeowners insurance, and for Don and I, that has been really good.
Grange Mutual Insurance is sold to enrolled Oklahoma Union Grange 349 members nearly 300 last count, the fourth largest grange in the state. Members pay $25 a year, and most have joined the grange precisely for the insurance, although a handful still enjoy the grange tradition.
We're supposed to meet once a month, and we haven't been able to meet. We haven't met in quite a while.
And why is that?
Well, some of my younger members won't come. They just simply do not come. There's too many other things to do. There's too many other fun things. And I pick up my mama, and I pick up my Aunt Neva, another lady that's 70 years old. My Uncle Dean comes off the hill, and my brother comes off the hill. And that'll just be about it.
Are you talking about Loretta?
Uh-huh, I pick her
That's
up.
Jennifer's mom, 86-year-old Helen Londigan, who helped to start up Union Grange back in April of 1956.
And we lived on Flint Creek. We had a farm, 189 acres, and we raised green beans and alfalfa and irrigated them. And somebody from Arkansas wanted to start a grange. Well, the man across the street creek from us was interested, and he got a bunch of us together, and we started it.
Helen was raising her family at the time the Grange was established at the current hall, which back then served as the local schoolhouse.
My daddy went to school there. I went to school there, and three of my kids went to school there. A one-room schoolhouse to begin with. It's two rooms now.
A dozen members attended in the early days. Helen brought her five children. Now she has 10 grandchildren and 10 great-grands, with one great-great-grand on the way.
Well, we'd have ice cream suppers and come and eat and just do games and stuff.
Helen was among the first at the Union Grange to sell the homeowner's insurance. Today, Oklahoma has 17 granges, which meet once a year in October in Tulsa, officiated by the state grange master, to come to consensus on certain initiatives and bylaws. Jennifer Larman loves to attend those.
I like it, but I'm the pianist. Dawn is a board of director, and Mother has served as a Pomona several times.
A Pomona is an official position. More about that in a minute. The term grange derives from English baronial estates filled with ritual and symbolism. A gatekeeper is assigned to keep watch at the entrance of the hall, while officers with titles such as master, overseer, steward, and lecturer officiate. An open Bible is often present during meetings. And women hold office under the titles Ceres, the goddess of grain, Pomona, the goddess of fruit, and Flora, the goddess of flowers.
And from day one, Grange has always included women.
Pete Pomper is a lecturer for the National Grange of the Order of Patrons of Husbandry, headquartered in Washington, D.C. He lives in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He said granges once filled a critical niche.
You know, back in the 1870s, there wasn't a lot of communication. People lived in very rural areas. Farmers might not see other farmers except, a few times a year, and he really didn't have a lot of idea sharing, those types of things. And when Oliver Hudson Kelly, who was one of the seven founders of the Grange, the man who was instrumental in the founding of the organization, went around doing a study for the Department of Agriculture back at that point in time, that was one of the issues he found, was that farmers did not have a unified voice, a unified way of disseminating information to each other.
The first grange was built in Fredonia, New York, and they proliferated and organized.
One of the first things Granges was known for, probably got her name on a map, was some Supreme Court decisions that are called, now referred to as the Granger Law, where the railroads, where the railroads had a monopoly on the transportation of products from the farm to the factory. And they could set the rates, they could, they controlled it. And the farmers got to the point where they could not basically afford to get their crops to the market. And when they did, they didn't make any money. So that was one of the unifying things for the Granges was, they lobbied, for lack of a better word, their politicians back at that time frame and got laws passed that made it fair for the farmers to get and break up some of the monopoly of the railroads.
Today, the National Grange educates members about critical issues and pending congressional bills and meet once a year nationally. Peter Pomper says Arkansas's last standing grange, Zion Oak Grange in Springdale, which disbanded due to declining membership, may revive.
There was a large amount of granges in Arkansas at one time, and you know they've kind of gone away for whatever reasons. And there was still one active grange in Springdale. It's a lovely old hall. Want the grange to grow and want it to flourish. They're just looking for younger members to carry on the traditions. You know, the older members would love to be able to tell their story of what their grange did, but they would like to get some younger, newer members to come in and help them keep their grange going and keep the hall going.
This is Ozarks at Large. That was a story that Jacqueline Froelich did earlier this year. Jackie, you and Christina worked together on the Social Workers series this year.
Yes.
And Christina, I remember you really, really enjoyed working on this series.
I did. I mean, this was Jackie's idea, and one of the reasons why I really enjoyed it was because Jackie's so talented, and it was so great to get to work with her.
As is Christina. Thank you very much for that.
But yeah, this was, and Jacqueline actually approached me with this idea, because a lot of people have a misconception that social workers, you know, just work for like the Department of Human Services, you know, taking children away or, you know, working with adoptions, but they really do so much more. They are in just about every, you know, setting. Jackie did hospice social workers, and I did one on hospital social workers. And then this one is about social workers that are in the schools and, you know, how they help not only the students and the teachers and parents, but, you know, the entire, you know, kind of community around the schools. So
I met Ananda through Bates School. When I first met her, it's like, I didn't like her.
That's Carmelita, a mother of four and off and on caregiver for nine grandchildren. She's talking about Ananda Rosa, a licensed certified social worker and social worker coordinator with Fayetteville Public Schools.
This is the woman, I mean, she was telling me this is what you got to do to help yourself and your kids, you know. And I'm going, who is this woman coming in my house and telling me what I got to do? But when she did that, that made me realize that she was right.
One of the main goals of Ananda's job is to eliminate barriers that can keep kids from succeeding in school. This usually involves working with parents to ensure that students have the proper support at home. As in Carmelita's case, it is often connecting them with the proper community resources.
She says, if you keep your Medicaid and stuff up, you won't have to worry about going back and re-signing up for Medicaid or anything like that. You know, she's helped me a lot. She's helped me when I needed a bill paid, or, you know, she was telling me different places that I didn't know that I could get help with a lot of stuff.
She has come such a long way, and she's just such a different person as far as just her stress level, you know, because it used to just be so overwhelming. And I mean, sometimes after I would talk to her, I would think, like, I don't even know how she survives. How does she get up every day? But she did. And I mean, it's a testament to her and how, what a, you know, her perseverance and her character, even under all of these crazy circumstances. But it was also because of the fact that we were able to link her with, you know, some support and to help her build a support system.
I met Ananda at her office, also known as the Outback. It's located at Fayetteville's former West Campus. With over 50% of Fayetteville Public School students on free and reduced lunch, one of the barriers to learning can be something as simple as hunger.
The families can come once a month and they can get food, clothes, laundry soap, toilet paper. We have some shampoo. We've got toothpaste. We've got basic stuff. We try to keep the staples, beans, peanut butter, granola bars, and some snacks, cereal, fruit. Rice, you know, just whatever. And basically what we do is we give what we have.
Brandy Foshi is the social worker with Owl Creek Elementary and Middle School in Fayetteville.
Owl Creek is 70% free and reduced lunch, so 70% of our kids are living at or below poverty line.
On Fridays, Brandy sends snack packs home with some of her students. A Walmart sack containing about 8 snacks.
Items that children could prepare for themselves. So instant oatmeal, instant macaroni, Pop-Top vegetables, Pop-Top fruit. A lot of kids, you know, they either only eat when they're at school or they only eat well when they're at school.
To put food in her snack packs, Brandy uses the school district's Outback, but also searches for her own funding, with a majority of it coming from area churches and other private sources.
Even though I've never missed a snack pack week, every single week, they'll be like, are we getting snack packs this week? Yes, yes, you're getting snack packs this week.
Her success story is another of helping a parent jump through the hoops of what can be an overwhelming system. A kindergartner was having trouble in class, drawing the attention of his teacher to the fact that he could not hear. His mother, hearing impaired herself, had grown frustrated with trying to get help, inadvertently applying for food stamps rather than our kids for her son. That's when Brandy stepped in.
For a lot of these parents, it's just there's too many steps, you know, too much red tape. Sometimes they just need somebody to kind of hold their hand and walk them through it, which is really all I did for this mom.
She's being modest. Brandy went so far as to drive the family to Little Rock for an appointment at Arkansas Children's Hospital. Her inspiration comes from her own childhood, one that she describes as being less than ideal.
And grew up with lots of different people taking care of me. I was never in the formal foster care system, but I was fostered informally by a couple different families. So I got to see kind of social work from that perspective.
Fayetteville Public Schools has 3 social workers, Ananda, Brandy, and one other. They primarily work with the higher need schools. Rogers School District, however, has 7 social workers. All students, no matter the school, have access to a social worker, making the district unique to Arkansas. Patsy Roycroft is the social work coordinator in Rogers.
In a lot of schools, what they're doing is compartmentalizing. So I only work with homeless, or I only work with special ed, or we only work with this. And that's the advantage to the way we're set up in Rogers, is we work with all of the students.
It wasn't always like this. Patsy actually started the social work program in Rogers, and she began in the junior highs.
Research shows that when kids transition from the 6th grade into the 7th grade at that time, that is when we start kind of losing kids, if you will, because they go from having a homeroom and, if you will, a more nurturing one environment to 7 classes a day, so it's just more challenging for students.
Dealing with secondary schools differs from elementary. In the high schools, Patsy works more closely with students, helping them to develop life skills.
A lot of students don't see that, you know, they're developing patterns of behavior, of being tardy, being absent from school. And obviously, if they had those behaviors with a job, they wouldn't have that job for very long.
She says that they work very closely with the counselors. Her office at Tucker Elementary is next door to the counselor's office. It is similar at all of the more than 20 schools in Rogers.
We have different skills than what the counselors have. Counselors are very much academics and testing and scheduling and those types of things. Social workers, because there's, especially at the elementary level, there's one counselor per school. And so if we need to do home visits, which is something that we do a lot of, the counselor can stay in the school, then we go out and we do the home visits. So we very much work as a team.
School social workers also work very closely with the teachers, often relying on them to be the eyes and ears. On this particular morning, a teacher alerted Patsy to a girl who was saying her family was moving into a hotel.
So I was calling the mom just to see if they needed any access to community resources, what their living situation is. Some of the time that does happen, we do have quite a few homeless students in our district, and we want to make sure that they have access to community resources.
As it turns out, the little girl was just confused. Her family is actually moving into an apartment. Though poverty issues are often the root of problems, it isn't always the case. A year and a half ago, David Lehans, a firefighter and married father of 4, had a tree trimming accident, leaving him unable to work.
So we were trying to make all those adjustments and had been told by the surgeons that I may have to retire. So we were looking at all of our different options and trying to plan ahead. And Vicki had a lot of insight into the fact that, you know, with all this coming about and with young kids in the house, what we might be able to do and what our future would look like and how we could plan for that. And she had been in a similar situation, and that really helped my wife to be able to have somebody to connect with and talk to about that.
Asking for help wasn't something David was accustomed to, but the relationship with the school social worker aided him and his family get through this dark time. He imagines his life had he not made this connection.
It's very likely that my wife and I would be divorced. I guess it's, you know, with animals, they just kind of accept that the end is near if they can't get up and move and do and take care of themselves. Well, I had kind of looked at that and said, you know, if I can't take care of myself and my family, what's the purpose of all this?
The school social worker helped him find that purpose by showing him the light at the end of the tunnel. He and his wife are in the process of starting a nonprofit educational farm.
This is Ozarks at Large. I occasionally get excited about stories that I do. And sometimes it's interesting to see your reactions when I tell you how excited I am about a certain thing. That's the exact laugh I got. When I came back from a tour of the Fort Smith landfill. Mm-hmm. It was one of the best afternoons I had all year.
I thought you were kidding when you said that.
No, I just had such a blast. What happens at a landfill, it's amazing what's going on there. Actually, the city of Fort Smith sanitation rates are going to be able to go down because they're so effective at what they do. Anyway, everyone should do this. You should call, see if you can get a tour, because it's wonderful. It's a new kind of tourism. You should tour the Fort Smith landfill, but here's part of my visit while I was there. We expect certain parts of our lives to work like clockwork, set the trash and recycling out at night, and by the same time the next day, it's been hauled away. But from the curb to the landfill, a lot happens. Just ask Baridi Nokokeli, the director of the Fort Smith Department of Sanitation.
So I'm going to take you over here to the working face of the landfill.
Baridi loves giving behind-the-scenes tours of the Fort Smith Sanitary Landfill, as he did late last month in his SUV. Last year, Baridi says, more than 2,000 people had a similar guided journey around the landfill's campus. Baridi, who has been the director of the department for the past 7 years, says he wants his guests to come away with a better idea of the science and engineering involved in trash.
Especially in the mode of environmental concerns, because we want to ensure that they understand a lot of people put out their waste, their trash at the curb before they go to school and they go to work. And then they come back and they retrieve the empty container. No one really thinks about the in-between. Well, we like to show them the in-between. We like to show them the life that their trash takes, the journey that it takes in effect.
And a lot happens here. The publicly owned facility, the largest in the state, serves about 400,000 people in Fort Smith, Sebastian County, and the counties bordering Sebastian. The landfill is open 6 days a week, 314 days a year, and last year accepted 300,000 tons of solid waste. Much of that waste is taken to what Baridi calls the working face of the landfill, but not all of it. Household hazardous waste and white goods like refrigerators and air conditioners are taken for no extra charge and disposed of properly. The white goods are separated, and after licensed employees extract the CFCs in those units, the scrap metal is hauled away by companies, and the landfill receives a percentage of the sales. This isn't a dump where refuse is simply thrown away.
Instead of this area or this landfill being a dead end for waste, it's a point of transition where things can actually be recycled and returned and reused in the environment. Beneficial reuse.
Similarly, yard waste is turned around too. More than 7,200 tons of yard waste was brought to the landfill last year, and the resulting compost, about 1,400 yards, sold back to the public at $10 per yard. That's about 300 pounds per $10 bill. But the rest, the trash that does need to stay at the landfill, it meets the compactor. The blue vehicle with spiked wheels is the rock star in the landfill. Every piece of trash that can't be repurposed is taken to the working face of the campus and crushed below the compactor's medieval-like tires. The vehicle's sheer size, as Baridi describes it, is densifying the waste.
It is densifying it by going back and forth and is crushing out or smashing out all the voids and all the moisture. So all it's doing is densifying as much waste into the smallest area possible.
The process means about 2,000 pounds of trash can be compacted into an area of 3 cubic yards, thus drastically minimizing the rate of expansion of the landfill. Baridi says the business model at the landfill is to protect resources, so he preaches the gospel of waste reduction and recycling to schools, civic groups, anybody who will listen. He says he's proud that though the landfill is the largest by land permitted in the state, it's third in the volume of waste, and he'd like to see that amount diminish each year.
Hold on, we're in a four-wheel drive, so we might as well have a little fun in our four-wheel drive.
Any really exciting tour includes something unexpected. And on the boundary of the landfill, terrain that was once part of Fort Chaffee, there's a piece of forgotten history that was unearthed when Chaffee officials began surveying for a walking trail.
And they had mentioned to us that their site maps show that there is a bridge out here. Well, we didn't see a bridge. We didn't know that there was a bridge out here. So we came out to take a look, and I can see you're looking, and you don't see
it
yet.
No.
Well, this is the bridge. There it is.
How about that?
Yes. And that is a bridge from the WPA.
Built in 1941 and still in pristine condition, despite decades of exposure in the wooded area. Baridi says there's also a practice machine gun turret somewhere nearby that he also plans to uncover. But if you're looking for something unexpected at the landfill, you don't need a guided tour in an SUV. There's a park, complete with playground equipment and picnic tables, at the landfill's entrance.
This was a mosquito-infested swamp-like area. Had standing water that was foul-smelling. It was a catch-all for all the debris that was blowing off the trucks as they entered and exited the landfill. And I thought we could do something to demonstrate the efficiency of a landfill. And I thought that the way this area looked, it didn't help us in that regard.
Spend an afternoon with Baridi and you'll understand that he loves his business, a business he never thought he'd make his life's work when he began as a sanitation worker in Houston to pay for college in the late 1970s.
And even though I had started and was somewhat ashamed to be working as a sanitation worker, I was reminded by some of the older guys that it was just 10 years earlier that Dr. King had given his life, inadvertently, representing sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. In 1968. So I just kept that in mind, that here was 1978, 10 years later, and if it was good enough, if sanitation workers were good enough for Dr. King to come and represent during their strike and their working conditions for better working conditions, and in fact lost his life there, the least I could do is have some pride and admiration for what we're doing. And I've been in ever since. So not only did I get myself through college, I also was able to put my sister through college, my brother through college, and also subsidize my brother's medical school, and he's a practice physician today. And I did all that through solid waste management.
Baridi is perhaps proudest of the fact that the Fort Smith Sanitary Landfill has not asked for a rate increase for 5 years.
And in fact, I will be approaching the board of directors next year, about mid-2013, to offer a rate decrease to our customers. That's right. The efficiency of automated collection is such that we are going to pass on savings to the citizens. So I know it might sound crazy, but we're actually going to be offering a rate decrease of at least $1.10 per month.
Baridi Noko Kaley is the director of the Fort Smith Department of Sanitation. All right, so maybe not everybody wants to go to a landfill for a field trip or a day off. Hmm. But here's a hypothetical question to end this Christmas broadcast. I have an unlimited amount of money that I can give you, and you can go somewhere and do a story anywhere on the planet. We're not going to say Mars or anything.
Okay.
Where would you go? I'm going to start first with me. So since I'm asking to give you time to think about it, I would go to Reykjavik, Iceland. I would love to do a story about
Iceland.
I've had
a lot of friends going to Iceland lately.
Yeah?
It's been their economy went down, so it was really cheap to go there for a while. I think it's gone back up, but...
Yeah, you could have bought it for about $1 billion at one point, right after the crash in 08. Hmm. But I'd love to go to Iceland. Mm-hmm. Timothy?
You know, you asked me this question the other day just about going on vacation, but to do a story, I would like to go to Antarctica.
Ah.
See the supply chains that they have to get supplies to all of the bases there.
Oh, that's a great idea. It's a great idea.
You could work as a prep cook.
Exactly.
I've known a person who worked as a prep cook so he could live in Antarctica.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
wow. Christina.
I think I'm half Swedish and still have ancestors or, you know, relatives, not ancestors, but relatives that live on a farm in Sweden that my family goes back probably 200 years. And they still live in the same farmhouse. And I think I would like to go visit my family in Sweden.
Okay. Jackie?
You know, this is not vacation. I would go to Bikini Atoll to see ground zero of the nuclear tests on the Marshall Islands. And for two purposes, to bring that forward, because I think it's a history that's getting continually buried, but also and to honor the people who were a national sacrifice area for the United States government during a Cold War, but also to rout out the indigenous culture of the Marshallese, which was consumed by layers of missionaries and colonialists. And I know that there's likely people with oral histories and indigenous stories. I'd like to collect those.
You know, there are grants. We should get you there.
I think so.
No offense to Antarctica or or wherever, or Sweden. Have I asked you yet, Katie?
You have not.
Where would you go?
This is not a very original answer, but probably Berlin in Germany. It's just one of my favorite cities. I lived there for a while. I had best friends growing up from Berlin, and it's a cultural hub. And the Renaissance that has taken place there since the Berlin Wall fell down, it's just a really exciting place to be, and I would love to go back there.
Okay. And Antoinette?
I have no idea. I feel like I can make a story out of anything. There's stories everywhere. So... someplace with a beach, so when I'm done with the story, I can hang out on the beach.
Well, that's it. You're coming with me to Bikini Atoll.
Well, there we go.
There we go. All right. Well, we've got three more shows of this week, but everyone, thank you so much for doing this, and Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas.